Hello and welcome to episode 4 of the Marie Keating Foundation Talks Cancer podcast. Today we're speaking to John Wall, who many of you may have heard of. John is living his best life with advanced metastatic prostate cancer. In this episode, he shares his story with incredible honesty, discussing what living with cancer is like for him and how it impacts not only his life, but also the lives of his loved ones.
John, at 46 years of age, your life changed. Tell me what happened and how your life was then.
Yeah, it did. Back in July of 2017, almost 5 years ago, my life took a bit of a turn. I should say our lives took a bit of a turn. My family, my friends. I went to the GP with what I thought was a pain in my leg. A very innocuous thing, really. But it transpired that it was a lot more serious than that. In the space of a few hours, I was sent from the GP surgery to the Galway clinic, and they knew there was something wrong straight away. I didn't. I guess from the commotion around me at the time, I figured that there was something up. And to be brutally honest about it, all I saw at the time was, you know, I was going to have a few days off work. Mm-hmm. It never occurred to me in any way, shape or form that I'd end up in the position that I did end up in. But I did. And that evening, it became unfortunately only too obvious to those around me that I had advanced metastatic prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. So it took a few days for the news to filter, I suppose, to me. But when it did, it changed everything. It changed absolutely everything for me and those around me.
Mm-hmm. And did you have any indication at all? It sounds like you didn't have any indication, but was there anything that you'd look back on and say?
Yes, I'd look back on everything, not just anything. I look back on everything. And that's why this conversation for me is extremely important. It creates awareness. And I was basically asymptomatic for the most part, or so I thought. Mm-hmm. I didn't know much about prostate cancer, even though there's a small history of prostate cancer in my family. But it didn't register with me at all. In my mid-40s, I was relatively healthy. And I had my whole life to look forward to. Going back to the pre-diagnosis, for me it involved, looking back on it now, I was urinating quite a bit at night. Mm-hmm. Thought it was just middle age. And that was something that I just had to deal with. And that was absolutely fine. I didn't think anything of it at all. I did go for a blood test to my GP. I went to my GP. He took bloods and my PSA levels were elevated beyond the extreme. But it was prostatitis as far as anyone else was concerned because of my age. I was age profiled and I would have been, I suppose, too young in the norm to have advanced prostate cancer or even the thought of it. The symptoms in terms of the frequency of urination and slight pain didn't dissipate at all. So I went back to the GP after about 3 or 4 weeks and another blood test was done. The results were the exact same. Elevated PSAs in terms of numbers, mine was over 700. And again, prostatitis, I was given antibiotics and I was sent home and that was fine. And at no point, that was over the course of maybe 8-10 weeks, at no point did I consider prostate cancer as something that that I should be thinking about in the background, that all the warning signs were there. Mm. But I didn't know the signs. Mm-hmm. I had absolutely no clue. And on the 25th of July 2017, I went back to the GP for a third time. I saw a locum. Locum looked at my chart and was warning signs for him all over the place. And he brought in my regular GP into the room and had to look at the elevated PSA levels, frequency of urination. I had abdominal pain at that stage. And the other issue was the pain in my right leg. And that's the evening I was sent to the Galway clinic. And that's where the journey started in earnest.
Quite shocking, isn't it, John, you know, to have considered a, you know, you talked about a PSA of 700 there. You talked a little bit about a family history and not, you know, and actually not knowing the signs and symptoms. And there are probably a lot of men out there like you, you know.
There are many men like me. And as a result of what has happened to me, I've now, I chat with men all the time that are going through, I won't say something similar, because fortunately they're able to either recognise the signs, or indeed I'd be a huge advocate for regular health checks for men. And it's not something that we do on a regular basis. We wait for something to go wrong before we go to our GP. Yeah. Where on the other hand, I would say to men, certainly from once you pass the 40-ish age mark, I would say go to your GP once a year, even if there's nothing wrong, just to get an NCT done on your body.
Yeah.
Bloods, and just a once over. And a lot of men are doing that now. And for the most part, thankfully, there's nothing wrong, and that's fine. Yeah. See you next year. But for some men, issues like prostate cancer can be detected very, very early. We don't have a national screening process. And I understand there are issues surrounding the merits of whether, you know, that would be beneficial or not. But in the absence of, we have to look after ourselves as men and not, you know, wait for others to look after us. And prostate cancer, thankfully, is one that if caught early enough, it's very, very treatable.
Yeah.
And it's only for the minority of us that don't catch it in time, or it's not caught in time, that it becomes problematic and incurable.
Yeah. You know, the 5-year survival rate of prostate cancer when it's caught early is 94%, you know. And like, you're there, John, you're telling your story and you're making that information, you know, available to men to seek help early.
Yeah, yeah, hugely important. Yeah. And you mentioned the 5-year survival rate. That's something that I used to look at all the time in the early stages of my diagnosis, because the 5-year survival rate for me, it was okay, but not great. But it'll be 5 years next month and I'm still here and doing very, very well. So there's another message too, in that no matter what the diagnosis is, no matter how bad it may seem, where there's a heartbeat, there's life, and where there's life, there's hope. And in my own case, I think the support of family, the support of friends, and I suppose a zest for life.
Yeah.
You can overcome a lot alongside the treatment options that you go through along the way, whether that be, in my case, it was chemotherapy, surgery, and radiotherapy, and hormone treatment. And a combination of all of the above has got me to where I am today. And I look forward to, you know, a good life. I don't look beyond the horizon. I look in the here and now and focus on what matters. And that's the people that are in my life now. And it's, to date, I've been fortunate that things have worked out for me. That won't remain the case. But we'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
Yeah. And I am so grateful you're here today to talk to us. You've been through a lot of treatments, like you mentioned, surgery, radiotherapy, chemotherapy, and hormone therapy. Your first treatment was the surgery, wasn't it?
Chemotherapy was first.
Oh, sorry, chemotherapy was your first one, in order to reduce the prostate down and to downregulate it to a degree.
For me, it was the lymph nodes.
Yeah.
In order for surgery to become an option or a possible option, the lymph nodes were severely inflamed, because I have primary prostate cancer, secondary in my lymph nodes. And chemotherapy was the first line of defense, which I received in Limerick. And I was petrified of chemotherapy, absolutely petrified, because I'd heard all the stories, I'd seen people, and I had this impression of what was going to happen, what I thought was going to happen. But very fortunately, I got through it unscathed. And I met some great people during the chemotherapy sessions themselves. It facilitated great discussion. Actually, one thing that I've come across over the years with chemotherapy is when I underwent mine, we sat at a round table. There was four of us, and it facilitated discussion for those that wanted to talk, and those that didn't just put on a headset or read a book or whatever. But I've heard in other places where it's like a ward almost. People are lined up side by side. Doesn't facilitate much discussion. And there are times during treatment that it really is nice to talk. I found it incredibly therapeutic that when that needle was in my arm, I was scared. I was alone. I was very, very scared. But the people around me, and not just the healthcare professionals, but other patients, they were going through the same thing. They were just as scared. And in many instances, we ended up talking to each other,
yeah.
which I think it was a support within itself.
Yeah. And there's nothing like being with somebody who's going through something similar or even feeling the same from time to time, you know, to be in that same space.
Yeah, we start exploring each other's thoughts and what they're going through. And you have a very honest conversation at a very, very raw time in your life. And those conversations for me got me through a lot and got to the point where I started to meet the same people during treatment because they were on similar treatment paths.
Mm.
And there's many I've never seen since, but some I have. And, you know, almost we recall some of those sessions with fondness, not because the needle in their arm and in our arms, but for the people that we met and the conversations that we had.
And the camaraderie that takes you in life, isn't
that, it? That was the start of it, the camaraderie. I couldn't believe. I'll tell you a little story about my last infusion, the round table. And there was an elderly gentleman sitting beside me. And he was obviously a bit of a character. And he started telling jokes. And they were funny. It was good fun.
Yeah.
But then he started talking Oscailge. He was a teacher in a former life. And I was trying to pick up the few words and answer back as best I could. But then he started singing. And I started singing with him. Mm-hmm. Now, this was in the middle of the day ward in University Hospital Limerick. And all we were missing was two pint glasses in front of us. And then other people joined around us. And we had a little bit of a sing-song.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to describe how emotional that was, but how beautiful it was. At a point in time and in a place that you would least expect it, we had a sing-song.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never forget it. It taught me and it showed me what's possible at any moment in time, regardless of what's going on around you.
So an extraordinary situation in a chemotherapy unit, which has actually really helped, I'd say, along the path.
Yeah, it taught me what can be achieved and what can be overcome.
Yeah.
And there are others that day that must have looked at us and thought, you know, what are you guys doing? But then when it happened, there was a lot of smiles all around.
Yeah.
A little bit of embarrassment because I haven't a note in my head. But it was fun.
Yeah.
And that's important.
Yeah. And humour is really, part of what comes into play here, too, for some people. And I think it's really, really important.
Yeah, it's been something that that has been, I suppose, beneficial the whole way through. There's dark humour. I use it all the time.
Yeah.
And sometimes it can be used as an icebreaker because there are many people that find it difficult to talk to someone that's living with cancer.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know what to say.
Yeah.
So a little bit of humour, break the ice and off we go.
A little bit of a coping mechanism
too,
isn't
it? Yeah, it works. Yeah.
So that was your chemotherapy journey. It sounds very interesting. More interesting than I've heard before. And I suppose then that moved you into another place and space in terms of further treatment.
It did. Throughout the chemotherapy, I began to realise what was about to lie ahead. As I did a little bit more research and along with that, I listened a little bit more to what my multidisciplinary team were telling us. And the surgical option became apparent that was the only option, that were I not to get surgery, that life expectancy wouldn't be great.
Mm.
So that was a real eye opener. And over the course of the couple of months following, actually it wasn't even a couple of months, it was about 3-4 weeks following chemotherapy, we visited a couple of surgeons around the country to see what could be done for me.
Mm.
Fortunately, the chemotherapy was successful and the nodes were shrunk enough, but there was a small window of opportunity where I could be operated on. But unfortunately, as I found out, there was no one that was willing to operate on me in Ireland. And that for me at the time, and my wife was, it was shockingly difficult to be told, I'm sorry, there's nothing we can do for you. Get your affairs in order. I'll never forget those words. and they were said to me more than once. That was the end, as far as I was concerned. I couldn't see any way out. Mm. You always have a plan B, a plan C, a plan D, but we didn't. Now, fortunately, my urologist that I met the original evening that I was diagnosed, he knew somebody that he thought may operate on me. And that was a surgeon called Stephen Jeannot, and he's based in Belgium.
John, can I just kind of come back there for a minute? Like you said, you know, there was nobody that could operate on you in Ireland. Was that because of the complexity of,
yes,
of your cancer itself? Yeah,
it was advanced. Okay. And yeah, there was a significant risk attached to surgery, and the benefits, all felt that the benefits of surgery were such that there would be no benefits to me were I to go ahead with it. And there was a mortality risk, okay, an increased mortality risk also. And at that stage, surgeons and the professionals here in Ireland, they were concentrating on my quality of life.
Yeah.
And trying to manage as best rather than prolonging the quantity of life. Because it's whilst I looked okay inside, that wasn't the case. It had spread to just below my aorta from the prostate. And that's a significant, part of the torso.
Yeah.
Where the cancer had spread too, so they just didn't see any benefits. But fortunately, there was one person that did, and that's where we pinned our hope. And I went over about, it's only about 6 weeks less, actually, about 4 weeks after chemotherapy, we went to Belgium, to the University Hospital Leuven, which is a centre of urological excellence. I must stress as well that the surgery that I had was not experimental. It was routine.
Okay.
But just not routine
in Ireland.
Here in Ireland.
Yeah. Okay.
So I met my surgeon for the one and only time. I've never seen him since. And he sat down with myself, Deirdre, and Deirdre's brother, and we went through the options of what I should do, what I shouldn't do, and the benefits of having surgery. And it was all very new to me. It was in a different country, and that consultation lasted for about 40 minutes, and he left, and a doctor came in, took a few notes, and I thought I would see the surgeon back again that day, but it didn't. No, the next question I was asked was when can you come back for surgery?
Okay,
it happened that quick.
Yeah,
and a month later, that's exactly what happened. I returned for surgery.
Okay. Wow, what a story!
It was a roller coaster. It really was at the time, but I can look back on it now.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, I wasn't thinking beyond, you know, that moment in time.
Yeah.
I wasn't thinking of the severity. Everyone else was. Mm-hmm. I wasn't. The severity of the surgery that lay ahead. Ultimately, what happened was I had my prostate removed. I think it was about 71, was 61 or 71 lymph nodes removed as well, which is quite a bit.
Very extensive.
It is, yeah. It was expensive open surgery. Mm-hmm. So I have a rather large scar. I don't know, stitches-wise, 70, 80 stitches, something, I'm not too sure. They were figures, actually, that at the time I would never forget, and thought that I would never forget.
Yeah.
And as I recounted now, I'm actually glad that I'm not able to remember, because they become something that's just not important to me now. I've moved on, which is important in life, too.
Yeah. And that's incredible, you know, to have had that kind of extensive surgery. And to be here, you know, and telling us how good that was, and how much maybe you don't remember some of it, you know.
Yeah, the body and mind, I think, is an amazing kit, in that to protect myself, I didn't have to of what was going on at the time. Where it kicked in for me is when I came back after surgery. I couldn't walk very much at all, and I came back with a catheter. Early, I came back after 2 weeks. I just wanted to get home, and we pushed the boundaries to get back, and got an ambulance down from Dublin over to Clare, and I had a real difficulty walking, and had a catheter in as well, so I was incontinent, and that was very difficult. That was 47 odd at the time,
yeah,
and I liked walking,
mm-hmm.
and that.
Did- Did you know, John, that that was going to be a consequence of the surgery or not?
It was all told to me.
Okay.
And I have it written down in notes, but it didn't register.
Okay.
It just didn't register. And I'm glad it didn't, because I didn't have any qualms about having the surgery done. And I can look back now and say, thank God I had it done.
Yeah.
But looking back, if I were to think too much about the difficulties that lay ahead, I may have questioned. Yeah, I certainly would have found it an awful lot more difficult.
Yeah.
But that's the coping mechanism for me that worked.
Yeah.
Difficult for those around me, because they saw what was happening. I look back on pictures during surgery or just after, and I looked like a mess. I have one picture of myself. It's a very personal picture, actually. Not something I've ever talked about. After my surgery, I was taken down to the high dependency unit. The blood pressure was very, very low, and I wasn't very well. But I had my phone with me, and I can't remember anything else other than I was basically a state of undress. I had I was lying with tubes everywhere, and they had taken off the bandages, and it didn't look very pleasant. But for whatever reason, I took a picture of myself, and that's the only thing that I can remember. I don't know why I did it or why I wanted to do it at the time, but there are times now, rarely, but I look back on that picture and it's a real eye opener for me of where I've come from.
Yeah,
It's a real, real eye opener.
That gives you a lot of hope, doesn't it?
Oh, it does, yeah.
I mean, I'm hearing hope the whole way through your story here, you know, that and actually the challenge of going through complex surgery that wasn't on offer here in Ireland. And then coming to, you know, quality of life and getting through the complexities of the surgery itself. Some of those lingering, I suppose, unwanted effects, are they still there?
Yeah, there's many of them that are still there. And just going back to hope for a minute, there's no cure for me, but there's buckets of hope.
Yeah,
that's what I have. And it's free. It's there. And it's fortunately something I've been able to avail of.
Yeah,
and it's served me well, I think. There are a lot of side effects to the surgery. You know, it's funny that when you have a functioning prostate, you have no idea what it's for, and then it's taken away. Oh, really?
What was it for?
That's what it was for.
Yeah,
incontinence would be one for me that I live with on a daily basis. I am fortunate that. For the most part, it's under control. But I wear pads.
Yeah.
I wear one pad a day, and it's not it's something that I've, you know, some people I guess have would be, you know, not comfortable talking about wearing a pad. Yeah, I do. And
I'm glad you're talking about it, John, because there are many men out there wearing pads after, you know, prostate surgery, that are uncomfortable about it and don't like talking about it.
Yeah, well, it's something. It's a. You know, it's something that's just become part of my life.
Yeah.
And even yesterday, I ran out of pads. And and it's something you just have to get. So I got to a pharmacy before it closed. It's like putting on socks for me. I wear a pad, that's it. And
part of your life.
But they're very comfortable. I mean, some fortunately don't have to. Some don't like them. For me, it's just become a part of my life now that, you know, yeah, listen, if we're going to have an honest conversation, I suppose let's have it.
Yeah.
When I go to the bathroom, you know, for a guy, manhood at a point in your life is, I was going to say it's everything. It's not. But, you know, we talk about our manhood, etc.
Yeah.
Mine is that the size has reduced considerably as a result of surgery.
Yeah.
And even going to the toilet is an issue. Because unless you're very careful, you'll mess everywhere.
Yeah.
And it happens.
Mm-hmm.
Aim is very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. And whilst some may, I suppose, find the conversation a little bit difficult to listen to, or it's something that I deal with all the time, because another issue when I urinate is I urinate a lot. It's you feel you like you have a full bladder, but you don't. And it's only when you go, you figure out you don't, but you have to go.
It's in complete emptying, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. But again, that's something that, for me, it's very, very easy to live with.
Yeah.
That what I do during the day, I make sure that I'm not too far from a toilet. That you start to do things subconsciously and you don't think.
Yeah.
And it makes it it reintroduces normality back into your daily routine. That's my, it's not even my new normal now. That is normal to me.
Yeah, yeah. And John, did you, I suppose really just for listeners, because, it, you know, it is a difficult topic to talk about. Did you get any help like from, you know, continence advisors or physiotherapists to actually, you know, get this right for you to where it is now in your normal?
Physio, not so much. But I did get help in term for psychological help.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. That's something that I would be very, at the time, I didn't think I needed it until I went. And I saw a therapist in Limerick through the HSE. And the first conversation I had with her, I was gobsmacked, absolutely gobsmacked, that there were so many issues that that I wasn't dealing with that were unresolved as a result of my diagnosis, that became apparent the more we talked. And that those conversations, once every 3 weeks, once every 4 weeks, I really, really looked forward to. Because I suppose, extol the virtues enough of talking, of conversation. Or if somebody isn't comfortable talking, of listening to someone that is, or that someone that knows what they're talking about, for me, being able to discuss what was going on in my head at that moment in time, it's really difficult to describe how beneficial it was for me, but I knew it at the time. I really did. I released a lot of emotion. There was a lot of pent up upset, no anger, just I was upset. And I found it difficult to cope with what was going on in my life and what was going to happen in my life as a result of the diagnosis.
Yeah.
And that, I suppose, gave me the skill set and the ability to live a good life. Just to live a good life and to accept what had happened and understand that, I suppose, I was the one that could change or influence myself in how life was lived and how I envisaged life was going to be. And I suppose it goes back to something that that sticks with me, is the day that I was told I was going to die is the day that I started living.
Wow. It's a very strong statement, isn't it?
Yeah, I took life for granted before that.
Many of us do.
We do, yeah. I really did.
Yeah.
But when you stare mortality in the face and it's looking right back at you, you have two choices, sink or swim.
Yeah.
And for me, there was only one option. So I learned to swim.
You learned to swim and swim very well.
Well, I go under the odd time. But, do you know, I'm saying that it's important too to acknowledge that, you know, there are bad days.
Yeah.
I have some really bad days. But I acknowledge them to myself. I'm not afraid to shed a tear. I'm not afraid to talk about them. And maybe afraid is the wrong word. I have the skill set that I need to be able to acknowledge them and to be able to talk about something if I need to talk about it and to acknowledge and not be honest with myself, and my own emotions, my own feelings, and indeed to be honest with those around me in that, you know, the proverbial, it's okay to be not to be okay.
Yeah.
It actually, it absolutely is.
Yeah.
There's no shame whatsoever if you're having a bad day. And God knows when, you know, when people, when you're told that that you have cancer, when you're told you're going to die as a result, that can be considered a bad day.
Certainly. Yeah, for sure. And John, you know, you're so inspirational. But I do want to come back to, I suppose, what you would say to men. You know, I think we know that men wouldn't be great seekers of that kind of psychological, you know, help and support that you got. What would be your message to men, you know, in a similar position to yourself?
Honest conversations.
How do they get there?
Honest with themselves.
Yeah.
I think even men that don't perhaps or maybe are not comfortable discussing their innermost thoughts or indeed about not just their thoughts, but issues revolving or about their bodies. they do listen.
Mm-hmm.
And I have found that, for example, as a result of this conversation, there are men out there who will listen to this mm-hmm. and thinking, okay, so bits of it will resonate.
Yeah.
And if just one person gets a bit of help from this, as far as I'm concerned, job done. In that,
yeah.
that honest conversation with yourself, it has to start with yourself. I was in denial for mm-hmm. quite a while about how I felt about things and about thoughts in my head, what was going on with my body, and I felt uncomfortable. But I came to a point where I started discussing discussing what was happening to me and in my life with others. And some of those people have now become my best friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm quite happy to say now at nearly 51 years old that I think I'm in tune with my emotions, with I'm happy with life. I'm in a really good place, and all because I had the conversation with myself. I think those that even someone that's shy and maybe not too comfortable discussing with others, we all think, we all have that thought process where we, especially men, whether it's about our bodies or, you know, as we get older and the aging process kicks in, there's a lot of bravado
mm-hmm.
and we don't like to admit things that happen as we get older.
Yeah.
Not in public or even in private with friends, but we do to ourselves. And when it comes to your health, whether we like it or not, things happen. Whether we're healthy or not, things will happen. And there are things we have to live with. But I guess my message would be that it is possible to live a good life, even though under the hood, as it were, things aren't going according to plan.
Mm-hmm.
And but it is possible to live a really good life. But don't hide it.
Mm-hmm.
Don't brush things under the carpet. When it comes to your health, if you have symptoms or not, go to your GP.
Yeah.
Make that visit. If it's just once a year, do not take your good health yeah. for granted.
And don't procrastinate. You know, I think men sit on issues and problems, as you say, for a time, you know. But also, like, we are coming back to the point here that prostate cancer can sometimes not have any symptoms at all. So yeah. that message is loud and clear coming from you, John, from somebody, you know, who's been diagnosed with a later stage prostate cancer. And I hope people are listening to that today. I really do. So, John, something else that you've said there is, you know your destiny here. You know this cancer is not curable. And I know something you'd said as well is that you had pain. That was probably one of your first symptoms. But and in that, did you seek the services? I suppose we're having an open, frank discussion
yeah.
here. So did you seek the services of a palliative care team to help you in, you know, with what you were going through at any point in time?
I did, yeah. Although my impression of what palliative care meant was completely wrong until I met palliative care. Palliative for me would have, I suppose I would be consumed with images of death.
Yeah.
But that is so not the case. That for me, palliative care was about pain management. And I had substantial pain that was affecting my quality of life. So I was referred to a palliative care consultant
mm-hmm.
and it's a meeting that changed everything for me. He looked at the medication that I was on and he said, you need to come off this, that and the other, and you need to go on that. And I did.
Okay.
It changed everything. Yeah. Within a matter of days, everything changed. My quality of life that I had craved for but was being impacted by the pain. When you have ongoing pain, it really can cause absolute havoc with your quality of life. And when something is constant and you cannot get rid of it, your thought process becomes very complicated. And you start to go drift places in your mind,
mm-hmm.
a lot of negative thoughts. And it causes all sorts of problems, which it did for me. But got the pain under control, and everything else fell into place because of palliative care.
Yeah.
And it was also good to know who palliative care are, what they do, knowing full well that I'll be back to them in due course. And it may not be just for pain relief.
Yeah.
But I'm comfortable with that. That's fine.
Yeah. And that, you know, that conversation and the openness that you're actually telling me about is what we need to hear, isn't it? Because, you know, that's about managing symptoms and getting you the best quality of life that you can and helping you to live your best life, which is where you're at. And it's great to hear that. And it's also, unfortunately, the realization that you may have to revisit them again at some point.
Well, I will have to.
Yeah, you
but
will.
I won't be shying away.
Yeah.
You know, palliative, as I said, conjured up all kinds of images, but now, no.
Yeah.
They're there to help.
They're there to help you and actually to help you live your best life, aren't they?
Yeah, and they're incredible at what they do. And not just, it's not just pain control. I mean, I've friends that have passed away recently and I've seen with the intervention of palliative care, the, you know, the incredible work that they do to ensure that when you get to a certain point in life, that it's made, you're made as comfortable as possible. And with that, you know, those around you, that, you know, if you're comfortable, that makes their lives easier. It comes as a full package. And palliative care, palliative intervention are really understated when it comes to cancer care in this country.
Yeah.
They really are.
It's a very holistic approach to care, isn't it?
It is, yeah. But when you experience it and when you go through it and when you see others going through it at various different stages, you begin to understand how important it actually is as part of the process.
Yeah. And within that whole kind of like caring holistic approach, have they helped you with like thinking ahead or planning ahead?
Palliative, not so much yet, although the services are there. I have thought ahead. And by virtue of the friends that I've made, some sadly no longer with us and some that are, thankfully, we talk on a pretty regular basis about the next stage. And we talk very openly. Sometimes it's not a conversation that's comfortable to have, for example, with family.
Yeah.
I've discussed one or two things of what I'd like to happen, where I'd like it to happen. And I think that's a lovely thing for me to be able to do myself in that, you know, there's a lot of people that that don't get that opportunity.
So true.
But I'm in a space in my thought process where I'm comfortable in my own mind's eye to talk about death.
Yeah.
Talk about when it does happen, that it's not just going to sneak up on me. I'm going to be ready, not just for the physical impact, but I'm going to have a say in what happens, where it happens, how it happens. And that's very important for me. Very, very important.
I'm going to put my hand on my heart because I think that's, it's just so reassuring for me to hear that, you know, that you feel that you can talk about this, that you have already talked about it with people who are going through it. So I think, you know, that is enormous. And I'm so glad you shared that. Thank you.
You're very welcome. It reminds me of a really good friend of mine passed recently. And I was talking about him the other evening. And as sad and all as it is, and it's shocking, he was a young man, three children, but all I see is the life that he lived, the good times that he had. He was an amazing, amazing man. And I look back with a sense of great fortune that I knew the man rather than a sense of loss. When you're in this kind of space as we're in, it gives you a completely different perspective on life, in that you savour the good bits and not lament what's not, or the person that is no longer here, as sad and all as that is. And of course I miss him. But what the overriding, I suppose, thoughts that I have are of a life well lived, a great friendship and good times.
And a gift to you and a gift to him. And I suppose before we end today, John, I think you have actually created a beautiful space for men to talk. and for families to talk about prostate cancer and late stage prostate cancer. I want to thank you so much for your honesty, and I knew it would be honest and open. That's the kind of man you are. But to have that for all men in Ireland available to listen to at their own, you know, at their own ease and their own pace, is tremendous, and it's a credit to you.
Well, thanks to the foundation for the opportunity, because it's one thing to, you know, to want to talk, but to have the platform to talk upon, I mean, that's just as important. And the foundation, the work that you're doing in terms of male mental health, and creating awareness surrounding everything men's health, but obviously in this case prostate cancer, you know, from this side of the fence to yours, thank you.
And will we part by saying it's okay not to be okay?
It absolutely is.
Embrace
it.
John.
Thank you very much, Helen.
That's all for this episode. Thank you once again to our brilliant guest speaker for their insight, to our sponsors Janssen for their support in making this series possible, and to all of you for tuning in. Join us next time, where we'll once again be talking all about prostate cancer. In the meantime, you can visit mariekeating.ie for more on Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. Tune in next time, but until then, have a great week.